Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to a special edition of Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. I would be Bradshaw. That would be your Chickasaw native, your Chickasaw Hall of Famer, Mr. Gerald Briscoe. And what a great treat we have today. Played with the George Thorogood brand, Mr. Jim Suler, Mr. Bud Whittington with John Mayall. They have an album out, came out right in 2009, didn't come out till this past year. Texas Scratch. It is the greatest name ever as a God bless Texan me growing up. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, man.
Hey, guys, I want to ask you a question about your style right off the bat. You know, in Texas, I grew up there in West Texas, Sweetwater, Texas, and growing up, there's a few things, you know, that are sacred. There's Nolan Ryan, there's Earl Campbell, there's Roger Staubach, and there's three guitars on stage. How in the world did these three guitars come to be such Texas-centric music? Did it come out of the old Western swing of Bob Wills that did transferred to guitars? How did that sound originate that you guys now have made such a wonderful album that could has just come out?
Well, I suppose it could have had a lot with the the harmony playing that was in the Wills band and all the swing bands going on back then and everybody having their own harmony part to play and it coming out in one big beautiful chord, you know.
So you guys kind of took the guitars and replaced the fiddles, the Bob Wills fiddles and all that in there, basically.
Well, not exactly, but it's a good thing we didn't have any fiddles between. it's a good thing I didn't have one because I don't know what to do with one, but I do love that music and I try to play it a little bit every chance I get.
Did speaking of Western Swing, did you guys ever play the Cage Ballroom in Tulsa?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. We have something in common. We've been professional wrestler. I don't know if you guys are aware of that, but the Cage Ballroom also doubled as a professional wrestling arena also.
I didn't know that.
And when I was right out of Oklahoma State University, my brother also, we had our training in the Cage Ballroom. They'd set a ring up during the weekdays and then tear it down, of course, on the weekends and have the Cowboy guys come in and play their concerts. But growing up in Oklahoma, I was always a huge country fan. And walking in a cathedral-like Cage Ballroom was always goosebumpy to me. So that had to be a thrill to play in a place like that.
Yeah, it was great to play there, especially after I kept up with as much Wills history as I could and read all the books and knew a couple of the guys, you know, that the latter-day guys like Tom Morrell and Hambone Cunningham and guys like that had played a little bit with Bob toward, you know, like in the 60s. Yeah. And it was great to learn as much as I could about that stuff.
You know, people that aren't from Texas don't understand how diverse some of the big cities are. You know, Austin is completely different from San Antonio, completely different from Houston. And Dallas is actually completely different from Fort Worth, even though they're only about 35 miles apart.
Yep.
Jim, I was watching an interview you did talking about the difference in music between, say, Dallas and Fort Worth. You know, I started wrestling at the Sportatorium there in Katy's and Industrial in South Dallas, where Elvis played, right by the Longhorn Ballroom, where a bunch of great acts used to play.
Big D Jamboree.
Oh, man, the worst part of town ever. Yeah. If you check for weapons when you come in, if you don't have one, they gave you one. It's rough in there. What was the difference between styles of, say, different Texas cities that you were talking about, Jim, or Buddy the One?
Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, well, my personal experience was the guys in Fort Worth were more well-versed in country than in Dallas because of, groups like the Texas Playboys were based there, and it was just part of the, I think the working musician was probably required to cover more of that stuff than the guys in Dallas. I think maybe there were just more rock clubs in Dallas, and Fort Worth is known as Cowtown and has the stockyards, and it originated as a fort to repel Comanche Indian attacks when it was founded, I guess in the mid 1800s, and that's probably still reflected today. So, I think that might explain it. What do you think, Bud?
Well, I would go along with that, but there's also a lot of really great swing and country players out of Dallas, too, that I hadn't played with until back when I was playing that kind of thing every week, and I was always getting to play with somebody. You know, like I say, talking about Morrell and Hambone and George Upmore, and then just a bunch of guys that were all real great players.
Yeah, I was late to that party. I didn't realize how great that stuff was until I got a little older. I just had rock and roll blinders on and, soul music blinders in my youth.
Well, me too. I'm just still trying to learn how to, I take a stab at it every now and then. I'm not real good at it, but I go out and play a little bit once in a while, especially with my country duo buddy, Larry Funches. We have a little duo that we go out and play with, and play all those tunes. Or as many of them can.
And I guess you guys kind of consider Austin like the Willie music style, right?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Jim.
No, I was going to say, if it wasn't for DFW, Austin's music scene would have been pretty barren, certainly in the 70s. I mean, probably three out of four of the people in that Antone's, that was in that Antone's orbit were from DFW as far as the blues thing goes. But, Austin's just so much more, it's really atypical of a Texas city compared to the other Texas cities like Dallas, San Antonio, Fort Worth, Houston. It's complete, it's just got a totally different feel to it.
Of course, when you get down in Houston, that's where you guys kind of blend in with your style of music with the Billy Gibbons, ZZ Top style of music down in that area. Right?
I guess so. I've always done well in Houston and had good crowds there and always had fun playing there. Great musical legacy there with the Duke Records label
and all that.
Yeah. Sure, and there's, I'm not into hip-hop and stuff, but I know there's a huge hip-hop scene there, which is kind of like a modern-day blues. It's just music from the streets. It's kind of serves that same function, I guess.
Yeah, I'm really taking off, too. But, speaking of that style of music, how did two Texas boys get hooked up to that Philadelphia rocker, George Thurgood? I got a great story about George. When I was wrestling in Philly one night, and George shows up. He's a big fan of professional wrestling. And
oh, yeah.
One of his heroes, Don Morocco, is one of my best friends. So we were there. We started BSing with him. He said, hey, guys, you mind if I walk you out to the ring? So we're wrestling two badass Texans, Dickie Murdoch and Adrian. Not Adrian was a Texan, but he was adopted Texan. But Murdoch, of course, Captain Redneck, we called him. And they're the two bad guys. So, we're in the ring, and George is having a good time. People are cheering us also. Here comes the two bad guys out there. And all of a sudden, of course, in the Philly crowd, here comes all the beer bottles, all the beer cans, and they're brushing up against George. George said, "Man, I don't know how you got. I got to get out of here." So, man, he hightailed it in 2 minutes back to the dressing room. There, he waited for us to get out of there. Man, how do you guys think? I said, "Well, it's just part of our gig, you know."
Yeah, I can't imagine a Philadelphia crowd being like that.
Oh yeah. My goodness! Oh Lord! It's unbelievable. Anytime something happens in Philadelphia, it's not like you're surprised. It's like, well, of course it did.
What took them so long?
That's right. What took them so long?
I don't know if you guys are about to say, but you know, there's places you know you love to play. Philly is one of them. Chicago's another, where the crowds are just so damn rowdy and so into what you're doing, you know, and it just brings the best out of you every night. Do you guys have venues like that also?
Well, we used to play Buddy Guy's Legends quite a bit, and one time the Mercurial, Mr. Mayall, like we got picked up by our booking agent at O'Hare, and he had a little Ford Taurus, and there wasn't enough room to get us all in there. So John said we put the suitcases in the back seat and got everybody wedged in around him, and John got in the trunk and rode all the way from O'Hare to Buddy Guy's Legends, and there's people standing outside in line waiting to go in, and we get out and open the trunk, and he gets out looking like he just had a nice refreshing nap, you know.
Right.
Always enjoy playing there.
So you put the bags in the back seat and mail in the trunk.
Yeah, and one time he rode in the trailer. We flew into Portland and had to go up somewhere in Washington, and he rode in the trailer with the gear. He was just a little quirky.
You guys have played with just about every major star there is in the business, and that's got to be so thrilling to share your music with the geniuses of your sound, you know, John Mayall, the B.B. Kings, all the people that you guys have played with there. And do you have a favorite that, you know, kind of your music just kind of naturally blended in?
As far as somebody we opened for or worked with?
Or just worked with, and not exactly opened for, but that was up there on the stage with them when you're jamming with them.
Well, as far as like just a bill that would go well together, I know when George played with ZZ Top, that was always cool.
Right, yeah.
We did a couple of shows with AC/DC, that was cool, And strangely enough, Sammy Hagar, because we hadn't worked with him until, I guess, last year. And I didn't know what to expect. And it was great. It was a great pairing. And he was so nice to us. We came off stage and he was like, he'd watch the show and said, "Man, you guys, I love you guys. You're like the AC/DC of the blues."
Wow. That's great.
I thought, well, I'll accept that. Thank you. As far as jamming with somebody like on stage, and George is friends with Elvin Bishop, and I got to be friends with him, and it was always a delight to work with him just because of what he played, the stories he brought that he could tell for hours, and just what a beautiful human being, just turned into a good friend. I have nothing but the utmost respect for Elvin.
Wow.
We had one of our guys, Dusty Rhodes, the famous old wrestler, passed away a few years ago. Everybody loves Dusty, you know, and Dusty would Dusty ruined a lot of concerts, right, Mr. Briscoe? Because right, Dusty thought he could sing, and he wasn't bad, but he wasn't good. Yeah, and when he get up on stage, like, "Oh my goodness, it's the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes," and then he just stayed. So, did you guys have any problems with like celebrities coming and all of a sudden they want to join the band, and you're like, up on stage and like, "This really isn't working out very well"?
my thing like that was John Mayall and the Blues Breakers were on stage with Peter Green and Keith Hartley, who was his former drummer, and Keith hadn't played drums with anybody in years and years, and Greeny had just come back from a long you know vacation, so to speak, and we got up and got them up to play with us a little bit, and we got on the back side of the beat playing a shuffle. And it was like everybody was looking at each other. It was like, "Let's stop for one beat, and then you know, and then jump over and get on the right side of it." But they looked like they, you know, they had the deer in the headlights thing going on for 3 minutes 42 seconds or whatever, you know.
So, Jim, the debut of your album, Texas Scratch, you found that I watched a bunch of interviews, and I told Mr. Briscoe on here, I said, don't ask them about why it took so long to come out. I said, you can tell they're tired of answering that question. But were you surprised, at least when you see it on Instagram, that all of a sudden, hey, I've got an album out?
Well, I was. I was pleasantly surprised because I'd given up on it. It's like when you give up on something, then it'll happen. You know, it was one of those situations. Because it had been 14 years. So, I mean, that's you know, like waiting for the Tooth Fairy or Santa Claus and never through the door, you know. So, yeah, I was stoked it came out because I always dug the album. I still connect with it, still feel good about it. So, yeah, I was happy.
How did Texas Scratch come about, you guys forming a little group and getting your music out there?
The guy that brought us together is from New York City, named Arnie Goodman. He owned the label that we were going to put it out on, I believe, and he's a music photographer, owned a record store in New York City, just a huge music fan. He's always got lots of ideas, and this was a good idea. It just came about in a convoluted way before it reached the marketplace. But he brought us all together. He knew us all individually, and I had never played with Vince or Nathaniel, the bass player, before. And I knew Buddy, and we had played together because, you know, we're living like 35 miles apart. But so we all convened in New Jersey, where I guess that's where guys from Texas would go to make a Texas album.
We've been to Jersey, so wow, that's a statement there.
It's a different thing. You know, I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying it's not.
We are.
I know if I say something, I'm going to get a shiv under the ribs somewhere. And when I'm in
especially in Jersey,
yeah,
you know,
some of the hotels we stayed at there, man, I was almost afraid to go to the bar, almost afraid.
Yeah.
I'd look through the door there. And I'd say, man, do I really want to go in there and get involved with those people? Yeah, I do.
it's kind of rough, but, yeah, we made it work. But yeah, that's the story about how we all, this project came together.
The studio was called Showplace Studios, and there was a common wall in the middle of the place that had a door that opened into a go-go bar, quote unquote. I presume it was a strip club, but the sign outside said go-go girls. And that's gives you some idea how long it'd been there. Anyway, it was funny because they had a poster in the control room that it was a Leslie West had signed his poster with of him, and it said Showplace Studios, best sounding room, worst looking girls.
That's Jersey. That's perfect. Yeah. How would you guys define your music? I mean, I was listening to the songs that they were available today on YouTube. I'd Really Be Lucky the Good. The couple songs that you have, I love them. Like, I grew up with that kind of music. How would you describe your music? Is it Texas blues? And what does Texas blues mean, if that's what it is?
I would say a little leaning toward the blues rock end of it. I mean, we had Freddie King around when we were learning to play, and of course, he was a blues man, but they rocked also, you know. And then again, there's Jim with talking about the ZZ thing. That was absolutely at the core of it, you know. And we also have a tune on there by a guy named John Nitzinger from Fort Worth, who is a well-known blues rock kind of guy. And he had an album out called Nitzinger in 1972. The song Louisiana Cockfight was a pretty good regional hit for him. And we just threw that one in the album because we just kind of wanted to give him a little bit of a tip of the hat. You know, he's still with us. He's not out playing anymore, but we just wanted to see if we could rattle his cage a little bit.
The name Texas Scratch, who came up with that? And was there any meaning behind it or what's the deal with that?
Your turn, Jim.
That was created by the brain trust of this project, Mr. Arnie Goodman. And I think it references a song Buddy wrote called I've Got the Itch, But I Ain't Got the Scratch. And somehow he took that and arrived at Texas Scratch because he said that means, you know, well, that's money, right? Well, yeah, but we still didn't see the connection. But having said that, that's what we're called. And by God, that's what we'll be called.
That's what you like.
So Arnie Goodman kind of put together a super group. I mean, he put together the guys he wanted that he thought would be a good band. Is that a fair characteristic?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe his template was there was an album in the 1980s on Alligator Records called Showdown that had Albert Collins, Robert Cray, and Johnny Clyde Copeland. And I think that may have been his, you know, his template for what we're doing. Of course, we sound completely different than that. I wouldn't call what we do blues. It's certainly blues infused or blues influenced, but you know, we've got that feeling. I mean, Texas is, as you said earlier, there's a lot of diversity here musically and culturally, more than a lot of outsiders may realize. So it's just kind of a stew.
Let's go back when you guys are getting, what influenced your music? Were you guys from a musical family, or did you guys just pick up an instrument and say, man, I want to be a rock star?
I started out watching Cowtown Jamboree and Big D Jamboree, you know, with my dad on Saturdays, and they would have these shows on Saturday night at the places y'all are talking about wrestling in.
Yeah.
And they would do a, like a 30-minute TV show to kind of get people primed up to get them out to the gig. And I would sit in there and watch them on TV. And the main reason I was there, I wanted to see what kind of guitars and amps they had. You know what I mean? I was very interested in that. And, you know, I mean, I saw a lot of early Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings, you know, when they wore turtleneck sweaters and no pigtails and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
But that was part of it. And my sister also was a huge record collector, and she had an unbelievable amount of like really cool 45s. And she would have Slim Harpo and Jimmy Reed and the Temptations and the Four Tops and the Beatles and the Stones and, you know, just whatever you can think that a teenage girl would have, you know. And anyway, the minute she wasn't in that room, I was in there with a guitar, putting the needle down, seeing if I could learn what they were doing.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Big D Jamboree. You know, it's changed so much how you make money off entertainment. You know, back then, Big D Jamboree, I guarantee they weren't making any money. I can't guarantee it, but I don't think they were, because we weren't making any money off our TV wrestling. We're using it as promotion for our live events. Things have changed dramatically just since you made the album and since it was released with all the streaming. What is the percentage now of roughly, not, you know, down to the number of what you guys make as, say, compared to, say, the 80s, off live events, off record sales, now off streaming? How has that percentage changed over the years?
Well, I think, you know, I think a lot of the pay, just for the performing pay, has pretty much been static. It's just stayed the same. And of course, the cost of living and everything else has gone up. Of course, I mean, there may be some other streams from songwriting that I didn't have then because I hadn't released stuff. But I think the musician's taken a hit. I mean, you've got to go on tour and you got to sell a lot of merchandise, and you're not going to make money. It's just the music, selling music is just completely changed. It's everything's free or nearly free now. And that's where it hurts the musician. Unless maybe you license your songs for other use. But it's just such a mixed bag, you know. But I think in general, it's probably been a negative turn.
And so much of the revenue you're making now is off the live touring. Say back, you know, 40 years ago, would it be more, a lot more significantly as far as record sales and live touring is just sign of an answer? Because we did both in wrestling. I don't mean to, you know, keep going back to wrestling, but we would go, and when we started making money off TV, we would go to markets just because we needed to promote the TV. So it changed dramatically. You know, now it's not just you're making money off live events, you're making money off the TV. Did you guys tour to make money off the records? Or was it kind of a 50-50 type thing back then where you were making good money off the records and good money off the live events, and now that's changed where you're making just most of your money off the live events?
Well, you're not going to make the same money on selling swag these days because, you know, you can't even buy a new car with a CD player. I mean, there are a certain group of people, especially our older friends, that do want a physical CD. But, you know, even have any way to sell anything as far as like a zip drive or something like that with an album on it. You know, I'm pretty sure Jim probably does because he's all caught up with that stuff and way into it.
Not really. I did try. I had a digital single I released and was had a performance here at the Kessler Theater in Dallas, and I was, you know, promoting it. People were coming up to me wanting to buy it after our show at the merch table. I try to explain this is a download only thing, and I'd say all that, and they would invariably say, "Yeah, but where can I buy it?" It's like it's just a foreign concept to some of the older people. But I agree, people want to have something they can take home, and it's yeah. You know, it's not sexy or attractive or, you know, cool. If I could figure that out, then I think I'd have more money.
Exactly. Well, same with all of it. Well, you know, you mentioned the merch table. You know, merchandising in our business was real late to arrive to our business. You know, I don't know about you guys as touring business, but, you know, and we kind of picked up the merch business from the Rock and Rollers, the Rod Stewart that was coming in town. You know, that's the first time I ever remember seeing a T-shirt of somebody with a Rod Stewart T-shirt that I went to a concert and saw all these little girls walking around with these T-shirts. Told a buddy of mine that, man, you know, we ought to do that. Well, we were crazy, you know, so we figured out a way to do it. Then merch just started getting bigger and bigger. And I know one of our stars, you guys probably heard Stone Cold Steve Austin for a while. He was making more money off of his merchandise than he was performing. So, you know, it became a main staple of income for our town.
Another great Texan, by the way. Mr. Briscoe, in case you didn't know, Jim, is a full-blooded Oklahoman and full-blooded native. So we have Cowboys and Texans against Mr. Briscoe. We've had a long rivalry for about 30-something years. I signed him up to a Texas retirement home up several years ago, and he found out about it. He never showed up. I don't know why.
Did you guys ever do the Northside Coliseum in Fort Warren?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely.
That was, I believe, the actual wrestling match was on Monday, and then they'd have it on TV late Saturday night.
Yeah, that's right. Kiss hey, Jim, I saw a clip in one of your interviews. Did you get married by a certain Reverend Willie B?
Mr. Gibbons, yeah.
that would be Billy Gibbons, for those that don't know the pseudonym of Mr. Billy Gibbons, but you got married actually by Billy Gibbons, right?
That's true. In 2002 in Houston, Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, Billy's a dear, dear friend of both John and I. We've been around the world with him. We were telling him earlier the story about running into him in Cape Town, or not Cape Town, but Sun City, South Africa, years ago, you know, and all of a sudden then you know, we started rekindling our friendship. And but yeah, I got a signed guitar right back here in the back of my room. So I was telling your partner.
Wait a minute, how did you end up getting married by Billy Gibbons? This is just, when I heard this, I thought this is the, I don't know why everybody's.
He had to call me and say, this is the best thing here.
I did. I called Jerry right before the interview. I said, he got married by Billy Gibbons. This is the greatest thing ever.
We had a guy, well, there were a couple people, the first couple he married was Joe and Julia Thomas, and Joe worked on our production crew, and Julia was our tour manager. And then he was the first couple that was actually married by Billy Gibbons. Little later, we had a guy that worked with ZZ that came over to work with us named Billy Hale, and I was going to get married, and I was talking to Billy Hale about it. And jokingly said, "Oh, it'd be great if Gibbons would do it." Ha ha. And he didn't say anything. And then like a week later, Billy Gibbons calls me on the phone, and I was like, you know, homina, homina, homina. I didn't know what I was like. Is this a joke? But I figured out it was real. And so that's how it came about. And he was great. He took it seriously. He was gracious. He was wonderful. His lovely mother, Lorraine, came to the wedding. And she was a beautiful, very classy lady. It was really cool. Yeah.
Is Billy actually ordained, or how is he? Was it a legal wedding?
He's a Texan, well, John. He's legally anything he wants to be.
He said he was. He said he was ordained in 49 states, but I'm. that part was a joke, I think. Keep us on our toes.
He's like Roger Staubach. He's in Texas and he's a legend. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, we went out, you know, and if you're going out on the town with Billy, especially in the Gulf Coast area, I mean, you know, like the Red Sea parts.
Yeah.
We went down to Kema, which is on the Texas coast. My wife and I, Billy went. I mean, we had, you know, we were all in the same hotel and we all went out, drank and ate and partied for like a couple of days. He was so nice and gracious, sent us roses. And, you know, he was just, I couldn't say enough good about Billy. It was all just very surreal to me because I always just feel like that kid listening to the records in my bedroom in high school, trying to, you know, figure this stuff out. And then the next minute I'm like sitting in a car with him listening to outtakes from his new record. Like, wow. I can just remember having this moment of clarity. I'm like, is this really happening? Like, how did this, you know, unfurl? But he's wonderful. What a big influence on both Buddy and I musically too.
Yeah, it's so wonderful when you meet your legend, your heroes like that, and they turn out to be better in real life than you imagined.
Yeah, I to be honest, I've never had any really bad experiences meeting somebody I idolized. Maybe somebody was grumpy or not having a good day, but nobody was like, you know, ever completely awful or anything.
Your album that you've got out now, Texas Scratch, it's took a long time for it to finally get out, but now that it's surfaced, are you guys going to do a follow-up to it? Are you guys going to tour any? I know you got other obligations, but I know it surprised you coming out. Is there any follow-up to it as far as touring and another album coming out, another collaboration?
Well, we don't know. We haven't gone that far yet, but like it sort of all revolves around what George is going to be doing, you know, because Jeff and Jim will be out doing that a good part of the summer anyway. Hopefully we'll get to do some more of it. And you never know about, you know, having another chance at doing another volume of it or something like that. We hope so, because we sure had a good time doing it. And we would like to do some shows with Jeff Simon on drums, you know, and Nathaniel, the bass player, I'm sorry he passed away right about the time the album came out. So I've been using the bass, but we Mr. Wayne Six, the bass player that plays with me in my local band here, has been doing the gigs with us. And Bo Chadwell, Jim's drummer, has been playing drums with us. And it sounds real good. But hopefully we'll get to do it and maybe get out and spread it around a little bit.
And the album Texas Scratch, where all do you buy it? Where all to plug all your stuff that needs to be plugged? Me and Mr. Briscoe are still using rotary dial telephones, so we're not any good at social media or anything else. So whatever you need to plug, we'll let you do it because we're not very good.
Well, it's available if you want the hard copy, you can get it on Amazon.com or Quarto Valley Records. .com, and you can download it from iTunes or any of those digital musical platforms and streaming like Spotify and that sort of thing. And all the dates will be on my website, jimsuler.com, and we do have a Facebook page, Texas Scratch.
You know, it's just that kind of music that's just cool. You know, you just feel good listening to it. You know, right. It's just good, cool music. You listen to it, you think, man, this has got a great vibe to it. You just sit there.
I cranked it up last night, man, and I was wild. I like this. You know, it takes me back home type music. And, you know, so I enjoy the heck out of it. So, are you guys going to tour with George anymore, or what's going on with that?
I've got a really busy year with George. It's going to start up in about a month for me, early April. And, I won't come up for air until July, pretty much. And then after that, I'm not sure what the dates are. I'm still waiting on some confirmations. So I'm a little bit tied up until I know more about my schedule with George. So there's not any booking conflicts.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. I love your album. I love the fact that we had a couple legends on. And I also understand, Jim, I think you're a Texas Ranger fan as well.
I am. I'm still on a high from the World Series.
Oh, I was on. My best childhood memories, my grandfather was blind later in life, and he would listen to the Texas Rangers on the radio back. And as you know, there were some very lean years back then. I'd go listen to the radio, the Ranger. I'm a lifelong Ranger fan. So that was as big a thing that could ever. My life is complete now that the Rangers finally sealed the deal in the World Series.
I'm so excited. I've gotten to be good friends with Eric Nadell. He's the radio voice. He made the call that they won, and he's been with them for decades. So I know he's seen some lean years. I mean, I used to go see him play when they were in Turnpike Stadium and they had metal bleachers and
oh yeah.
You know,
that's where you first saw him, right, John?
Absolutely. I used to go to those old metal bleachers, sit in the outfield because I didn't have any money. I'd watch Nolan Ryan pitch out there. You know,
God, it had to be hot sitting
out there. Oh, it was about 180 degrees out there. and Nolan Ryan just throwing nothing but fastballs. You know, he got that Ryan Express. That's where the name really came about, that hot August heat. Those batters didn't even want to face him at one point. You know, like fourth, fifth, and sixth inning when he got rolling, he was just unhittable.
Well, and real quick, I took the Destroyers were off one day in Dallas, and the Rangers were playing, so we all went to the game, and I took George up in the booth because I knew the radio announcer, and we were getting off an elevator, and the door opened, and there was Nolan Ryan standing there, like he was like, I mean, large to say he was larger than life would be an understatement. I gasped. I was so taken aback, and George said, "Hey, Nolan, can you still bring the heat?" And Nolan said, "Yeah, I can still get it up once in a while." There's only a couple of people I've met where I had that actual
palpitations there.
Yeah. So, yeah. Nolan's one of those guys. Yeah, he could be king of Texas if he wanted to be, if that was the office that you could actually be elected for.
Yeah. Right.
Well, hey, well, gentlemen, I know you got to run. We kept you a long time. Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. Good luck on the album. And, guys, it's been wonderful speaking with you today.
Thanks for having us, y'all. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you. We hope you're down in Tampa area here. I'll drop in to see you one night.
Yeah, I'll see you at Skipper's Smokehouse.
They closed Skipper's down.
Oh, they did?
They sold that damn place. What an iconic place. That's one of those other venues here in Tampa that was famous. But the guy decided he wanted to sell it. You know, it was out by the university out there, and I think he got one of those offers. I was at one of those concerts, by the way, too.
The drummer always said, he said, "We're going to go to Tampa and play at Gilligan's Island."
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being on, guys. It's certainly a pleasure, man.
Thank you, Joe.